succession number 25237, reel 1.
Could you give me your full name and date of birth, please?
I'm Leslie Charles Harling, born on the 21st of November, 1928.
And what was your rank on leaving the service?
Major.
And what were the dates of your service?
The 11th of July, 1947, to the 20th of November, 1983.
And so, were you a regular?
Yes.
And what were the reactions of your family when you joined up, and why did you join up?
I think they were a bit surprised, but I was inveigled into the Territorial Army. I was an apprentice with a firm of electrical engineers in South East London, studying at the South East London Technical College, when sometime in the early summer of 1947, this Remy officer turned up and gave us a talk, not very long, about 10 minutes, about the fact that he was forming a workshop company just up the road at Lee Green from where we were, and would we like to come and join? Well, the general consensus was that we didn't want to come and join, so we didn't take any notice of him. We were fairly busy, actually, because we got one day a week release to attend technical college, but we had to spend three evenings on other subjects. so we led a fairly busy life. The war was on. I was a member of the civil defence in South London. We were kept quite busy in 1944. Now, wait a minute, I got to get mixed there, haven't I? The war had finished by the time Captain Rowlison, he was. anyway, as I say, there were about six apprentices in the class from my firm. We didn't take any notice of what the captain had told us. About a fortnight later, we were sent for by the managing director. And we lined up in the corridor. We weren't actually permitted in his office. And he came out to the corridor and said, Captain Rowlison tells me that he came along to the technical college and invited you to join his workshop company, and nobody turned up, she said. Now, I have to tell you that this firm has a long tradition of supporting the Territorial Army. So on Wednesday next, you will all be in Captain Rowlison's office. What could we do? So we were all enlisted into the Territorial Army as potential radar mechanics, because, of course, we were studying electrical engineering. About six of us. It was 265 heavy anti-aircraft workshop company, Type B, REMETA. Now, I went on to do 3 years and some odd days, can't remember now, 153. I did 3 years and 153 days in the Territorial Army, and I learned a lot. Learned a lot in that time. we were required to parade one evening a week, and about one, sometimes two weekends a month. And of course, we did a 14 days camp, annual camp every year. Now, one of the things about this, we were paid a bounty of about £20 a year, you know. Well, as apprentices, we were getting about £3 a week, so that was a considerable sum of money. But in order to qualify for your bounty, you had to qualify on the rifle range. You had to be a minimum second-class shot. So as a result of that, we spent quite a lot of time on the rifle range, trying to ensure that we were confident to get our bounty, you know. It was very cleverly done. It worked out very well. As a result of that was, I reckon I fired more ammunition in those 3 years as a territorial than I did in the following 10 years as a regular soldier. However, it was an interesting time technically. I was enthralled by much of the things, the equipment that the military were dealing with in those days had only recently come off the secret list, of course. The magnetron, for example, you know, which is the heart of radar equipment, was on the secret list well into 1946. So it was all very intriguing. You know, we were, of course, studying heavy electrical engineering. We were taught things like pushing RF, radio frequency power up drain pipes. I mean, that seemed to us incredible. Because we had no radio frequency experience at those sort of frequencies, you know, which were unheard of in Civvy Street, the sort of frequencies that were being used at radar. So I found it all very interesting. Well, while serving as a territorial, it was pointed out to me that I could join the Corps as a direct entry artificer. Ah, now this looked interesting. The staff sergeant at that time, I think, was getting about £10 a week. Now that was nearly three times what I was getting. So I thought we'd have a go at this. So I sat a paper at Mill Hill, I think that was Three Command Workshop, something like that. Sat a technical paper there. I came down to Bailul Camp to do a leadership course or something, however they called it. Dragging barrels over rivers and things of this sort, you know. And I was accepted. So I think at that point I enlisted as a regular soldier. That was on the 11th of December 1950. And I was put on the Class W reserve until the 7th of January.
What did that mean?
That meant I'd only got paid for the day I enlisted. I'd been attested and pledged to serve His Majesty the King, so I couldn't get out of it. But they sort of said to me, you know, you've marked time until after Christmas, virtually, you see. So on the 8th of January 1951, I reported for duty at 1 Training Battalion at Blandford. To do recruits training, yeah, as a private soldier. And I was kept there for about 8 weeks. It went on a long, long time. Had a lot of problems there because at that time, in my unit, in the Territorial Army, we were wearing Canadian battle dress. Now, of course, because we were all wearing it, we didn't look, you know, it was uniform. But of course, it was a slightly different shade. It was more greener than British Army khaki. So when I got to Blandford, I imagine there were probably about 1,500 soldiers at Blandford, something like that, all wearing a different uniform to mine. That didn't help. And furthermore, for some reason or other, the territorials didn't issue me with a waist belt. Maybe they were short of them, you see, so they took it off me before I went to join the regular army. As a result of this, I had to walk about for a few days without a waist belt. And wherever I went, NCOs and officers went, "Where is your waist belt?" Eventually we got over all these problems. And it would have been about the end of February, early March 1951, I was posted to number 3 Training Battalion at Bailul Camp for even more military training as a potential artificer.
So what did you actually do as part of this training?
What did we do?
Yeah, what did you do? How did you train?
We marched up and down. We crushed the gravel over in Popperinge Barracks. We were spread out about 20 yards apart. One soldier on one side of the square and the other on the other, doing what was known as communications drill. Now the object was, you hollered at this fella to get him to carry out drill movements. But you had two fellas either side of you also hollering to another bloke, and the directing staff was saying to him, take no notice. So you had to holler louder and louder and louder. This was one of the things we did. We also did map reading and musketry, anti-gas training, throwing grenades about, firing the piat. This was an interesting... this was the projector infantry anti-tank that had been introduced quite late in the war, I think about 44. And it fired a bomb, you know, which was alleged would knock the track off a tank. I doubt whether it would have done, but it had a very, very powerful recoil. And the drill was to hold very as tight as you could to this weapon, and when you fired it, it pushed you back about 6 foot. Yeah. If there was any gap between your shoulder and the shoulder pad of the weapon, then you were likely to finish up with a broken collarbone. These are the sort of things we did, yeah, for our military training. Lots of drill, of course, there was stacks of drill. Eventually it came to an end and we were posted to 5 Battalion at Haysbrook Barracks for our technical training. And I was part of number 9, as we were called in those days, Armament Artificers Control Equipment. So we soldiered on here for about 18 months, learning about all this anti-aircraft equipment, some of which I already knew, of course, having come from the territorial anti-aircraft regiment. One of the things I always remember about that period, the King died in February of 52, and the very next day, every officer and Warrant Officer Class 1 appeared wearing a black armband. And I often wonder where the hell they got them from. I mean, there was no suggestion that the King was likely to die. He was a young man, after all. And it came straight out of the blue, but they produced these armbands overnight. Very clever, I thought, thinking about it later. And also, of course, the sergeant's mess had a picture of the King in Field Marshal's uniform. That disappeared the following day to be replaced no more than about 3 days later with a picture of the Queen. Wonderful how it all happened. Anyway, we carried on with the technical training, which was concluded in October of 1952. And I was posted to the depot. The depot Remy, then in Popperinch Barracks, across by the... I've forgotten the name of the pub over there now, but it wasn't far from the pub.
Bramshill Hunt.
Pardon?
Bramshill Hunt.
That's it, the Bramshill Hunt, yes. Just along from the Bramshill Hunt, which is very useful. So I'm loafing about in the depot, having been told that I was posted to Gibraltar. But there weren't any troop ships, I imagine. The Korean War, of course, was in full swing then. There was also the Mau Mau emergency in Kenya. So a lot of troops being moved about. So I came back to 5 Battalion and worked as a lab assistant in the survey lab to pass the time away. But eventually, I got a ship, and it was the 20th of December, 52. We sailed from Southampton on Her Majesty's troop ship Empire Fowey, packed with guys going to Korea, of course, mainly.
What was life aboard the ship like?
Pardon?
What was life aboard the ship like?
Well, it was very interesting. By the way, I only experienced it for 3 days, fortunately. We were in what were known as standees. There was a sort of pole welded to the deck and the bulkhead, and there were three sort of wire beds on this thing, you know. And it packed an awful lot of chaps. Now, I was right up in the forecastle, the sharp end of the ship. and I think the second day out in the Bay of Biscay, it was moderately rough. Not terribly rough, but moderately rough. Now, fortunately, I'm a reasonable sailor. I have been seasick, but that wasn't too bad, that trip. But it certainly affected many of my fellows. As a result, the deck we were on finished up with about 5 or 6 inches of vomit, which, as the ship pitched, it all ran up the funnel and it all came back this end. and the second morning out, there was two of us, I think, in the breakfast. I should, there were probably 1,000 soldiers on this ship, something like that, I should think. Anyway, we got to Gibraltar on the 23rd of December. The ship didn't tie up. We were put ashore in the launch, about 20 of us, I should think, something like that. About 4 o'clock in the afternoon, I think it was. And I think I was draft conducting NCO, but there was at least one more Staff Sergeant Remy with us, if not two. Anyway, we were bussed round to where Remy lived in Gibraltar, which was the Governor's Cottage Camp. Well, the next day, of course, was Christmas Eve. By the end of that day, there were very few sober soldiers about, and even fewer in the Science Press. The following day was Christmas Day, of course, and myself and the other two staff sergeants who came with me, and the adjutant and a couple of warrant officers, went round serving tea and rum to the soldiers in bed on Christmas Day, following which we served dinner, the Christmas dinner, to the soldiers. I'm not sure whether we got any ourselves, I can't remember that. So that was the Christmas holiday over. Well, I was then appointed to take charge of the vehicle electrician's workshop in the garrison workshop. Now, that was a bit of a blow, because I'd spent 18 months being instructed on electronic anti-aircraft computing equipment. I'd had no formal instruction on vehicle at all. But of course, I was a car owner. In those days, car owners always did their own repairs and servicing and so on. So I had a pretty good idea of vehicle electronics, electrics. And we did all sorts of things, rewinding dynamos, and they did very funny things there. there are a number of Dennis Tipper lorries on Gibraltar. Now, they would have been built, I would guess, about 1930. It was now 1952, and the workshop was stripping these vehicles down to the hangar brackets and rebuilding them at an enormous cost. Nobody seemed to notice this. A few years later, the casting policy was introduced, where you sort of had to justify the amount of time you were going to spend repairing a vehicle. And if it wasn't justified, then the vehicle was cast and they bought a new one, which was a much better idea than rebuilding 1930 vintage vehicles. But anyway, we did it in those days.
Which other vehicles did you work on?
Pardon?
Which other vehicles did you work on?
Well, I didn't work on vehicles directly. We'd had components, you know. We'd get generators and, of course, I was in charge of the shop, so I didn't go around rewiring vehicles and things. It was National Service days, you know. We had stacks of labour, people to do things. So I had rustled the paper about I did had one or two difficult technical problems. The garrison had a radio-controlled boat, which they used to practice their seaward defence gunnery. This continually broke down and would disappear in the direction of Morocco. The launches had to be sent out to get it back, and it would be dragged into the workshop, and we'd have yet another go at it. I can't remember now who built it, but it was very difficult to keep going. So that kept us fairly well occupied, this wretched target launch. But then I don't know how, I probably did about 6 months, and I was posted to the 5-4 Anti-Aircraft Regiment on Gibraltar as an acting AQMS. I'd only been a staff sergeant 2 years, and now I was acting WO2. So that was all right.
So what was life like in general on Gibraltar, and what was the accommodation like?
Not too bad. The sergeant's mess was in Governor's Cottage Camp, which had a cottage which had belonged to the governor, in which I assume he spent his summer holidays in the days when it took, you know, a fortnight to get to England, I suppose. I presume he must have given it up during the war or something, but it had, I don't know, probably a dozen rooms in which his servants, I suppose, would have lived, and staff and that have you. So it wasn't too bad. I should think over half the sergeant's mess were married and in quarters, so there was a fair amount of room. The soldiers lived a few hundred yards up in purpose-built huts, you know, that had been built probably during the war. So that wasn't too bad. We could get over into Spain fairly easily. There was a garrison pass system. Only, I think, 10% of the garrison were allowed out of the garrison at any one time. So you had to go and ask the company sergeant major to get a pass to go over into Spain. We generally got one at least once a month. And of course we went all round the bullfights, which was very popular. There was an Englishman fighting in southern Spain at that time, El Inglese, and we used to go and cheer him on, hoping he might get tossed, but he never did. He was a very, very clever bullfighter. He got away with it. They didn't all. I've seen one or two of them tossed in the air and severely injured, of course. So that passed the time. Occasionally we used to go to Tangier. There was a ferry from Gibraltar to Tangier. Not very often. Occasionally we used to go over there. And we had one of the chaps in the workshop was in fact a Gibraltarian. And he had a brother who worked on this ferry, you see, as some sort of seaman. So what we used to do, we used to give him money in sterling, because Gibraltar uses sterling, of course, and he used to take it to Tangier and change it into Moroccan currency and then bring it back to Algeciras and change it into pesetas and then bring it back to Gibraltar and give us our share of the pesetas. By these means, we made about 7%. So that was very useful. Yes, Gibraltar, life on Gibraltar wasn't too bad at all. But the following year, I suppose in the autumn of 1953, the Queen appeared. No, wait a minute. No, that was coronation, wasn't it? In 53. Oh, yes, and for coronation day, the rock was illuminated by searchlights, and there were letters about 20 foot high, E2R, placed right on top of the rock. The Scotsman, of course, objected to this, pointing out that Queen Elizabeth was the first Queen of Scotland, not the second. And so they climbed up the rock to remove one of these ones, which didn't please the governor and commander-in-chief at all. But actually, on the night of the coronation, the letters were up there, and the rock was illuminated by coast defence searchlights. Now, of course, these 90-centimetre searchlight projectors were designed to illuminate the sea. And they weren't designed to be used at these high angles. Furthermore, most of the crews were inebriated and didn't look after the searchlights properly. The following day, the day following the coronation, we had about 2 months' work trying to sort these searchlights. So the damage they did to them was unbelievable. Anyway, we did it. And another thing, the following day, the day following the coronation, a film of it appeared in Gibraltar. Now, that must have been very slick, because it must have been processed and flown to Gibraltar overnight, I presume. And about midday, the day after coronation day, there was a film of the proceedings. All these fellas staggering about in the pouring rain in London. Now, it was the following year, in 54, towards the autumn time it must have been. It was the Queen's last port of call from her Commonwealth coronation tour, she called in at Gibraltar. Needless to say, every serviceman in Gibraltar was on parade at on the airfield at North Front, Gibraltar. It was interesting, actually, because when we were doing the practices, the sailors for the parade, of course, were part of the Queen's escort, so they weren't available to do the rehearsals. So we had two sailors and about 5 fathoms of rope to represent this. And so it went on. The Garrison RSM was quite happy with this. But there was a song about the time, a popular song, something about String Along With Me, and it was Radio Gibraltar was requested to play it for the sailors in HMS Rook numerous times before the Queen actually appeared. When the Queen did appear, I ought to add that there was a hell of a lot of us on parade. There were 3 artillery regiments on Gibraltar at the time. Our workshop, the Remy workshop, was probably the next biggest unit. Probably about 300 of us, something like that, I would imagine. There was a squadron of REs busily digging tunnels in the rock. There was an RASC transport company. An awful lot of people creeping about it. Quite a lot of RAF, of course, and these fellows who came ashore from the Queen's escort no longer requiring the piece of rope, of course. So we were all on parade there, and I was in the front rank, quite almost opposite the saluting base. But when the Queen arrived, the first thing they did, of course, was to fire a 21-gun salute. Now, it was fired from 3 25-pounders, but each of them had 2 spare rounds in case they got a misfire. So, of course, they fired 22 guns. Now, I was counting, and so was the Duke of Edinburgh. And when the 22nd one, he looked quite bemused, because he was obviously counting too. The workshop presented the Queen with a train set for Prince Charles, who was very young at that time, of course. I can remember that. I didn't see much of the Queen other than, I think she was only there a couple of days. If that, maybe just the one night. I didn't see her again except on that parade. So we soldiered on Gibraltar. I should add that before the Queen came, the security was tightened up considerably. General Franco, of course, was running Spain at the time. He guy who had been a mate of Adolf Hitler and Mussolini and all that lot, and wasn't held in very high esteem. And I think, I'm not sure, but I believe that they searched a Spanish diplomatic bag. Spain had a consulate on Gibraltar. As a result of this, Franco closed the border, so we could no longer go into Spain, except by means of going to Tangier, and then from Tangier to Algeciras. That took a good day to do all that. We never went to Spain again after the Queen came. And I think the border was closed for a long, long time, long after I'd gone. Anyway, I was returned to home in December 1955, having done me 3 years.